new work posted on the archive last week. Let me just go through what I think is sort of standard by now is the sort of motivation for this kind of work. So the point is to try and reconstruct quantum theory from some more compelling principles, postulates, axioms, whatever you call them. The motivation for that is when you look at the standard mathematical framework of quantum theory, it looks rather abstract. And there's a lot of questions like why are states given by possible operators acting on a complex Hilbert space, and why all this structure? And you compare that with the situation, taking a look at Kepler's laws, which looks kind of ad hoc in the same way that quantum theory looks ad hoc. Newton came along later and provided a more principled explanation for those laws. And the same thing happened again. You look at the Lorentz transformations, they look very abstract, mathematically ad hoc, not at all reasonable, certainly much less reasonable, one would think, than Galilean transformations. And yet Einstein came along and explained the origin of these in terms of two postulates. So you have a kind of explanation for the structure, the reason behind those pieces of physics. And the question is, can you do the same for quantum theory? So there's sort of two motivations for this. One is perhaps we can make progress in understanding the nature of quantum theory if we can derive it from natural postulates. And second, and this I think is more important, perhaps we can go beyond quantum theory if we can understand where it comes from. So if you look, Newton's laws went beyond the laws of Kepler. They described a wider range of phenomena. Einstein's special relativity paved the way for general relativity. It's difficult to imagine how you could have got from the Lorentz transformations to general relativity without going through the sort of principled intervention of Einstein's version. And so perhaps a reconstruction of quantum theory will pave the way for quantum gravity. You can imagine that if you find principles that are sufficiently compelling, perhaps those principles will remain true in a broader mathematical framework in the case of quantum gravity. So here's a sort of potted history of this kind of subject. So really, I think the recent sort of wave of interest in this goes back to Chris, who implored everyone to find an information theoretic reason for the axioms of quantum theory. Certainly, I was motivated by that, as was the sort of parallel efforts of Jeff Boob and Hans Halvorsen and Rob Clifton. And so the sort of recent work that's been done goes back to this kind of bringing quantum information theoretic ideas to bear on this problem. So 10 years ago, I wrote a paper which is called Quantum Theory for Five Reasonable Axioms. And there was one of the axioms in there I really didn't like. This was the simplicity axiom, which states basically that states are specified by the smallest number of probabilities consistent with the other axioms. And that axiom kind of had a different flavor from the other axioms, and it was something I never found quite satisfactory. And I worked for a long time trying to remove that from the axiom set. And then recently, 2 years ago, there was various papers that I think that made substantial progress actually managed to get rid of this simplicity axiom in different ways. So first of all, there was the work by Dakich and Bruckner, who replaced the simplicity axiom with an axiom, the axiom that you can write down the state of any two-level system as a mixture of two orthogonal, or two distinguishable states. We call this G-bit state spectrality. There were some problems with their paper, but the ideas were good. There was some other work by Marsanes and Marcus, who replaced the simplicity axiom with the idea that all mathematically well-defined measurements for a G-bit are allowed. Incidentally, they also got rid of one of the other axioms in this paper. So they made a lot of progress also. And both of these works were sort of in a similar vein to this earlier paper. There was overlap in the axioms. There was a different scheme of axioms put forward by Giulio, Mauro, and Paolo. But if you look at what they do, it provides an alternative approach to doing something like getting rid of simplicity. In other words, fixing the dimension of the state space, the number of probabilities required to specify the state. So what I'll do here is I'll give a new set of postulates, finite dimensional quantum theory, and we don't need the simplicity axiom. And also, I also think these new postulates are better than the previous ones in the sense that I feel like they're deeper than the previous ones. I decided to start calling them postulates rather than axioms because one of the things I found when I presented the axiom to people was that people thought I was trying to do something very formal. To many people, axioms sound like they're something very formal, whereas postulates, I think, give more of a kind of informal feel that they're meant to be somehow intrinsically reasonable. So that's why I started calling them postulates instead. There's been a lot of work recently sort of trying to bring ideas from quantum information into the problem of rederiving quantum theory. This is a very incomplete list. And in fact, there's a very long history of attempts to reconstruct quantum theory. So these names and many, many more names. Much of this work is in the quantum logic tradition, although also much of it uses the sort of convex probabilities framework that I'll be using in this work. Okay. So let me just outline the new paper. So it's quite a long paper. It has a number of parts. In one part, I think it's the second part, I lay out what I call the circuit framework. So this is a framework for sort of a general framework for circuits, which I'll talk about soon. And it has three background assumptions. This framework is quite similar to the framework that's used by Giulio and his collaborators. And you'll find similar sorts of background assumptions there. Assumption one is the idea that circuits have probabilities. I'll explain what I mean by that in more detail later. Assumption two is the idea that there are non-trivial finite systems. And assumption three, which I won't go into in this talk, but it's a very natural assumption. It allows you to consider closed rather than open sets of states and transformations and so on. So it's mathematically very useful. This last assumption is really more one of mathematical convenience. It's very difficult if you have to work with dense sets rather than closed sets and so on. Probably could be dropped if one was to be more careful about those kinds of ideas. So that's one part of the paper. The next part of the paper concerns a mathematical reformulation of quantum theory. It's related to the quantum Combs approach of Giulio and his collaborators. It's also related to the multi-time approach of Aronov, Weidman, Popescu, and Tolleson. And it's also related to the general boundaries approach of Robert Urquhart. So you see, coming from three different traditions, there are similar sorts of approaches. The reformulation, the one I'm going to give you, is probably most closely related to the quantum Combs approach, in that it deals with general mixed states, not just pure states. The one I give in the paper. So I'm actually not going to go through this mathematical reformulation in this talk, because I don't have time. But the reason I have to give it in the paper is because I use it in the final part of the reconstruction of quantum theory from the operational postulates. So what I am going to cover in this talk is how this reconstruction works. Yes, you need this mathematical reformulation of quantum theory to complete the final step of the reconstruction, where you go from the case of qubits to the general n-dimensional Hilbert space case. So here's an outline of the talk. I'll talk about this notion of flat and non-flat sets of states in quantum theory. Then I'll talk about some basic operational concepts that are necessary to understand the postulates. Then I'll give you the postulates themselves, an overview of the reconstruction, and then if time permits, I'll go through some key parts of the proof, just in broad outline. So first of all, this idea of a flat set of states, or a non-flat set of states. So a set of states is said to be non-flat if it spans the space of the full set of states that's transmitted unchanged by some filter. So I'll illustrate what I mean by that. It's a very natural concept, but perhaps it takes a little thinking about. So here's an example in quantum theory. Consider a four-dimensional Hilbert space, which is spanned by some set of open normal states, n, and then define these states. So this is a sort of x superposition in the n, in the mn space. And this is a kind of y superposition to have the coefficient I in the mm space. And then I can define density operators on these states here. Okay. So here's two sets of states, set A and set B. Both of these sets live in the 1, 2, 4 subspace. Set A is non-flat and set B is flat. So you can see that set A is non-flat because all of these states I've written down here are linearly independent, and they span the space of operators acting on this 1, 2, 4 subspace.
The subscription, what row one?
Oh, row one is, sorry, it's just the projection operator acting onto one. Yeah. So if you look what we've got here, we've got the projection operator acting onto one, one acting onto two, one acting onto four, and then in each combination of these three, we have an x and a y. So we have a total of 9 linearly independent states, and this is a three-dimensional subspace. So 3 squared is 9, and 3, and n squared is generally the number of states you can find in a subspace of dimension n.
Does some filter mean exactly the same thing as
jetting
lives in a subspace?
Yes, it does, yeah. So the reason I say it like that is because I want to give an operational definition of this, which I do with respect to the idea of filters. I'll do that later.
But it means exactly the same thing. Because the filter, what a filter does is just cuts away some part of the Hilbert space you're not interested in, leaving you with a part of the Hilbert space, you're just projecting into the part of the Hilbert space you are interested in. So set A is non-flat and set B is flat. So that illustrates within the context of quantum theory these concepts, but you can have the same concepts in general. Oh, yeah, it's still be non-flat as long as they span the space. Yeah. The idea is that they should span the space of the full set of states that are trying to change. Yeah. Okay. So now this idea of a non-flattening transformation. So a transformation is non-flattening if whenever you send a non-flat set of states in, you get a non-flattened set of states out. An example of a non-flattening transformation in quantum theory is actually just the filter itself. So consider a filter that projects onto the 1, 2 subspace, represented by this projection operator. And then consider this set of states, which are non-flat, set A. You can act on each of these states with this projection operator, and these are the new states that you get. Now you've gone down to a two-dimensional subspace, but if you look at these states, they still are a spanning set. This set of states are still, and of course they're not all linearly independent because there's too many of them, but they still span the space corresponding to this filter. So they still span the space corresponding to the smallest filter that would cancel all of them and change. And actually, in quantum theory in general, non-mixing transformations are also non-flattening. They are only proved in quantum theory. Okay. So that was just a prelude that I wanted to put the idea of non-flattening transformations in a more familiar context. But of course, we're going to lift it into the general context for the purposes of reconstructing quantum theory. I'll define that later. What I mean, though, is a transformation that if you send a pure state in, then the state you get out is pure up to normalization. I'll give that later, because I haven't defined enough concepts yet. I'll give the operation definition. Okay, so now I'm just going to go through the sort of the operational notions that I need before giving you the postulates. Those of you who attended the talk I gave a few months ago will recognize the next three or four transparencies. So a basic idea is the idea of an operation. An operation is represented by a box. It has a number of features. It has inputs and outputs, which come in various types, A, B, C, etc. And these represent things like electrons or protons or photons, whatever, the different types of system you might send in, and likewise the different sorts of system you may have coming out. There's no reason that those types should be the same going in as going out or have the same number. This is a general operation. Another feature is that you may have a setting, so you may have knobs on this box that you can adjust for different settings. And I take that to be implicit, that the setting is already specified. I take that to be implicit in the notation A. So this A already includes a particular setting. And then also, you can have outcomes. So so there may be different sort of, you may have meters, with a needle that goes to a particular position, or lights that flash. So those would be the outcomes. Outcomes, incidentally, are distinct from outputs. So outcomes are, you could think of those as coming out of the side, and those are the sort of classical things you read off the meter, off meters and lights flashing from this operation. The outcome is actually given, is actually taken to be specified by this symbol A. So this would be given by some X of A. So if we have in place the appropriate apparatus, and then we actually see outcome X of A, then we say that operation A has happened. So you can think of operation A as belonging to a set of operations, each associated with different outcomes. Then you do the experiment, and one of them will happen. If you get the outcome X of A, then you've seen operation A. If you got the outcome X of A prime, then that would be saying that operation A prime has happened. Any questions?
The different classical outcomes.
So different symbols. So the symbol tells you both the outcome and the setting. So even if you have the same fixed setting with different outcomes, this was operations take one. Actually, I want to make it slightly more general than this. So watch here. So actually, rather than associating an outcome with every operation, I want to associate a set of outcomes. And now, if the outcome is in the given set of outcomes that are associated with a particular operation, then you say the operation happened. Slight generalization. Wires. We can imagine taking an output from here, like an electron, and feeding it as an input into another operation. There are some wiring rules. Most people have one wire connected to any given output, input or output. We have to type match. We have to make sure if this is an electron coming out of here, it goes into an electron input here. We don't allow closed loops. So if you trace around, you shouldn't be able to come back to the same box you started at. The reason for that is we're interpreting these operations as one use of an apparatus. So if you have an ordinary sort of no closed time-like curves, then you shouldn't be able to get back to where you started. Fragments. So you can imagine wiring together a bunch of operations and having some outputs left open. And then I'll call this a fragment. So a fragment has these various features. So it has a setting. The setting for the fragment is just specified by giving the setting at each of the operations. It has an outcome set. And the outcome set is given just by specifying the outcome set at each of the operations. So it's the Cartesian product of those. And then we say that the fragment happens
if the outcome at each operation is in the associated outcome set. And then also we have a wiring. So here's the wiring. I'm pointing to these pictures. You can also represent these things symbolically over here. And what's happening here is that each operation has something like this associated with it. And then you have the these integers tell you where the wires are going. So for example, there's a C wire connecting this B box to this A box. And that's C1 here and C1 here. Right here. So when you have a repeated integer, that means you have a wire between the corresponding boxes. So the integers are necessary when you give this symbolic representation, but they're not necessary on the pictorial representation because you can just see where the wires are going. Yeah. So the order of this thing, the order of these symbols, these large letter symbols, you can have BA. And likewise, these diagrams only have significance up to graphical distortions. So I can distort this diagram in any way I want, as long as I don't change where the inputs and outputs go. As long as I don't turn the boxes upside down, that I can sort of graphically distort the moving boxes around. Yeah, so here, for example, you may have, even if you had, something that was, chalk. You may, in quantum theory, have an entangled state where you prepare two systems of type A. And you want to be sure you know which one is which, because it could be that they're playing a different role. So the ordering of these letters in the subscripts and superscripts or along here is important.
C1 means the outcome for the outcome in the wire C when the classical outcome is 1.
These integers are just labeled.
And I could change a 1 to 20. I could change 2 to 3. I can change these integers with any invertible map in any way I want. They're just telling you where the wires go. So this is just a symbolic representation of this picture. Oh, you could. Yeah, I don't do that. So my attitude, the attitude I take is that the classical outcomes are just taken away. We don't try to feed them into the future. If you did want to do that, then rather than treating it as a classical outcome, I would treat it as a classical system passing from one box to the other. Yeah. Okay. Operation.
Into further smaller operations, why would you rather like that?
No, I don't assume that.
So could you have a sort of infinite regret, kind of continuum limit where you subdivide them?
I can imagine doing that, yeah. And I think that might be the way to try and approach quantum field theory, if you would say it's approach. So you could imagine drawing a box around a big sort of wire bunch of things like this, and as long as you have outcomes, and so outputs and inputs, and you could treat it just like this.
Is there any real significance in like having different letters on some of the wires? Does it matter whether it's got a C or an A on it?
Yeah, because C would be,
let's say C is an electron, and A is a photon. So this box is taking in two electrons and one photon, and outputting a neutrino and a photon. You have to be very careful because an operation only has. See, the thing about the fragments is this output here could go through some other bit of circuitry and then into here. And an operation. So I'd actually say an operation is a special case of a fragment. Yeah.
So a fragment is allowed to be connected up internally,
yeah,
whereas
yeah,
an operation is not.
Operation, just because you have no backward loop, no loops going back, you can't do that. Okay. And a circuit is a fragment that has no open inputs or outputs left over. Everything is closed.
Yeah, so circuits are special cases of fragments. Preparation. Preparation is a fragment which has only outputs. So here, there are two examples of preparations. One thing that's interesting about this language is, in a conventional way of thinking, you might think that this happened in the future of this, but this still counts as a preparation in my language, even though some part of it you may want to think is happening in the future. A result. I needed a word that corresponded to the sort of the opposite thing of a preparation. So this is a box that has only inputs. And I wasn't sure what the word was, so I ended up using the word result. So a box that has only inputs is something I call a result, or a fragment that has only inputs. So here's two examples of results. Oh, and a measurement is a collection of results which correspond to the same setup, but where you have disjoint outcome sets whose union is equal to the set of all outcomes. So just like we talked about before, you know, this letter D indicates also the outcomes. So we have to have a different symbol for each different outcome set. And the measurement is just when you have a disjoint set of outcomes, we have a result for each of those. Yes, in fact it is, yeah. So the setup is... So an operation is already, the idea of an operational fragment is already an abstraction away from the idea of an experiment, or a setup where you actually have some boxes in a laboratory. So, you know, if you go into a laboratory, no one's telling you that you have some inputs and outputs, so you have to abstract away the notion of an operation. But for a given setup, you may have different outcomes, I guess is the point here. So, you know, you may have a box here which can flash different colors. So that's the setup, and then you have disjoint outcome sets and union instead of all outcomes, and that's the sort of measurement.
Because isn't it like the mind basically that absorbs the outcome?
So,
all right. Okay. So this is the
yeah. I really just want to think that this is a piece of apparatus, you know, like something that doesn't take, you know, how the electrons go, and like a detector, you know, like, a photon goes into the detector and no photon comes out. That's the story.
You're basically saying there's only a classical result,
there's no further output. Well, this is a general framework, so we're not even talking about quantum theory specifically at this stage. I think it's clear. It's clear what this is. Whatever you call it. Okay, and a transformation. So transformation is a fragment that has inputs and outputs that is used in transformation mode. I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. So here's one transformation. We have some inputs and some outputs. Here's another fragment. Now, with this fragment, we could, in principle, take this wire and feed it into here. And then it wouldn't be being used in transformation mode. But as long as all the inputs are coming from below and all the outputs are going to above, then the thing is being used in transformation mode. In that case, it's sort of like you put a box around it and think of it as an operation. I think this kind of subtlety is potentially very important. We'll see. The subtlety of the different ways of using a fragment, either in transformation mode or feeding things into each other. So it plays a very important role in in this reconstruction in Giulio's paper, where you get the dimension of the state space. And I think something very interesting is going on in this situation. But I can't put my finger on exactly what it is, but it's very interesting. So. Okay. So here's a background assumption I want to make. If we have a circuit, I want there to be a probability associated with that circuit. And furthermore, I want that probability to be independent of anything else that's happening. So this probability depends only on the specification of a given circuit. Okay. This is a very non-trivial assumption, but it sort of seems essential in the background assumption to get things going. What it's really saying is there's no extra inputs that you don't know about. If there was an extra input that you didn't know about, then somebody could thwart your efforts to try and associate a probability with the circuit. Because if you thought the probability was a half, but still there was this extra input over here that influenced the probability of outcomes, they could just send something in to make your estimate of one half, your assertion that the probability is equal to one half wrong. So the probability is the probability that this circuit happens. What that means is you perform the experiment, you have the setup with all these boxes in place with this given wiring, and then you look to see if the outcome is in the outcome set. So that means that the outcome we see here must be in the outcome set associated with A, the outcome here must be in the outcome set associated with C, and so on. So all the outcomes must be in the outcome sets associated with each of these operations. Okay.
Doesn't happen, what does that mean?
Imagine in the setup I have a box here which has a red light and a green light. Now imagine my outcome set associated with C consists only of the red light. So I do the experiment, and likewise I have other similar things happening here. So I do the experiment, and I don't see the outcome associated with the outcome set here. Well, then this didn't happen. So now you might ask, well, how do I interpret probability? Okay, well, that sort of starts to get scary. But you could assume, whatever your favorite interpretation of probability is, if you're a frequentist, then you pull the experiment many times and you see what proportion of cases you actually have outcomes in this. If you're a frequentist. But yes, yeah, there is such assumption. So my general attitude is to try and stay away from those questions because they're scary. It does raise a sort of more general point, but it could be that a deep understanding of probability is what's really required to have a proper understanding of quantity and a fuller reconstruction. So the efforts, this effort and similar efforts are not addressing that question. Chris, this is true. So my attitude is to say is not. Although I think ultimately you need to understand probability to move forward. Okay. Right. So now I want to define this notion of a state. I hope we get to the postulates before then. 4, 3 o'clock. So we want to associate a state with a preparation. So here's an example of a preparation. And what I want a state to do is I want it to be able to tell me the probability for any completion of this preparation into a circuit. So here's lots of here's some possible completions of that state, that preparation rather, into a circuit. So to complete a preparation into a circuit, I need to put a result at the end of it. So here's a result. Here's another result. Here's another result. And of course, there are many possibilities. And I want a state to be able to tell us what the probability is for each of these circuits. So I give a state associated with this preparation, and then I can use it to tell you what the probability is for any circuit that has that preparation. So we could simply associate the state with a long list of probabilities for each circuit each result that completes that preparation into a circuit. So we then have the state associated with that preparation would just be given by a very long list of probabilities. Each of them for the same, each of them would be for the same preparation and some different results. Okay, so very, very long list of probabilities. But that would be kind of crazy if you had to actually specify the probability for every possible result. And so we imagine that it should be possible in general to pick out a subset of these probabilities from which all the other ones can be calculated. So here's the idea. We have the idea of fiducial results to define states. So let's take this example. Imagine we have a preparation which is of this form. Okay. And incidentally, these types can correspond to composite systems. So this is a general preparation. And now we choose a bunch of fiducial results. So here's so if I just cover this symbol. If you look at that, that's a result because it has a subscript. And then you'll see that I've got a label. You'll notice that there's an important difference now between the sans-serif font and the normal mass font. And this, so the superscript here is a label that goes from one up to some case of A. We want it to be such that the probability, we want it to be such that if I give you these probabilities, the probability for the circuit that's formed by the given preparation and each of the fiducial results, so if I give you this list of probabilities, then using that list of probabilities, I can calculate the probability for any circuit. So here's any circuit with that preparation by a linear formula, okay, where we're assuming that there's a summation over this this label A sub 1. Here what we have is a bunch of coefficients that are associated with the different results, and this we call it an effect. Are there any questions? Results? Of course, it's a bit compact. So certainly, if you're able to take arbitrary mixtures, then you can prove that the optimal case is linear. But linearity is optimal, and the optimal case has to be linear. If you don't, for example, even in quantum theory, if you restrict yourself to pure states, then there exists a compression with pure. My attitude is not to worry about that. I'm working with linear case. And this is sort of reasonable given this mix of. No. Because these are just different results, but these are results associated with different measurements. So here's an example. In quantum theory, if you have a qubit, or a spin half particle, these probabilities are sufficient to reconstruct the normal state. They don't add up to one. Okay, good. And so now we have associated with a preparation. Here, this is represented in sans-serif font. Here, the state represented in normal font. This is a list of probabilities. There's a list of K sub A probabilities. And then associated with the result, P sub A is an effect. This is a list of coefficients. Okay. So mixed states, these are standard definitions. Mixed states are ones that can be simulated by a mixture of preparations, or you can write them down as a complex combination. Pure state is one that's not a mixed state, so it can't be simulated by a mixture of preparations. Transformation is non-mixing if it preserves purity up to normalization. Okay, maximal sets. So a maximal set of distinguishable states is any set containing the maximum number of states represented by n sub a, for which there exists some measurement, a maximal measurement, which can identify which state from the set we have in a single shot. So I've illustrated that over here. Here's a set of states. N runs from 1 up to n sub a. And there exists a measurement which has the property that you get this delta function. Okay. And then a maximal effect is associated with each outcome of maximal measurements, each result, if you like, of maximal measurement. In quantum theory, maximum sets of states are associated with an orthonormal basis, and then maximal measurements correspond to the sort of standard non-degenerate observables. Maximal effects correspond to rank-1 projectors. In classical probability theory, you have a unique maximal set of distinguishable states, and that's the sort of underlying states of reality. In classical probability theory, you have a kind of simplex. Okay, a few more ideas. Permutation transformation. So this is a transformation associated with permutation. It's defined with respect to a particular maximal set of distinguishable states. And it has the property that if you follow a preparation by this permutation, then the thing that you get is equivalent to a preparation of one of the other states under that permutation. So it's defined with respect to a particular set of distinguishable states, and it's just permuting them in some given way. Sort of like if you have an alphabet and you want to, recode it in a different way, using A to B, B to C, and so on. That kind of thing. Filter. So here's the operational definition of a filter that I promised. So a filter is defined with respect to a given maximal measurement, and then also a given subset of the outcomes or the results associated with that maximal measurement. And it's defined to be a transformation. So any transformation is a filter if it passes unchanged those states that would give rise only to outcomes in this set, and it blocks states that would give rise only to outcomes in the complement set. So in the case of quantum theory, you would define it with respect to a given maximal measurement, so a given orthonormal basis. And then it would pass unchanged states that would only give rise to a subset of that basis. And it would block states in the complement basis. Or I can give you this in terms of pictures. So here's a filter. If the probability is zero, if this preparation has the property that it gives zero probability if the outcome is in the complement set. So in other words, this preparation has support on this set of sub f. Then the state is simply passed. Okay, so this you follow the state, the preparation by the filter is equivalent to just having the preparation. If the probability is zero. For if you have support for the cases where you actually have this outcome associated with that set, so the state has no support in this set, then the state is blocked. So it's equivalent to the null state. This is the state that has a list of zeros. So this is just the standard difference, the standard idea of a filter. It cuts away the bits. It cuts away states that are in the complement of some space and keeps the states that are in that space.
Non-flattening transformations.
I gave you this definition already. A set of states is said to be non-flat. If it's a spanning subset of the full set of states that are passed unchanged by some filter, and a transformation is said to be non-flattening if, whenever we send a non-flat solid state in, we get a non-flat solid state out. And quantum theory, non-mixing transformations, such as filters themselves, are non-flattening. I'd like to bring the toy I had, which explained this very well. If the set of states is flat, then if you look at them, they don't span the full space of states associated with the filter that they just passed through. You can't find any. So, you may have some set of states, okay, and they may all pass through a filter unchanged, but it may be that there's some other states you could also have that pass through that same filter unchanged, but are pointing in a different direction. I think it's the same. It's the same idea. It's just it's a spanning set of states. You could say spanning. I think the reason I'm using this different word is because it's not for the full space. It's with respect to some filter. So there just has to exist some filter for which it's a non for which it's spanning. So if I said spanning. So that's the reason I'm using the word non-flat, because then it means non-flat means there exists a filter for which it's spanning. And this is important because, you know, it may be that the original, you have a non-flat named transformation, it may be that the space associated with the original non-flat set is bigger than the space associated with the final non-flat set, but the transformation can still be non-flattening. These are the postulates. I'm just about to give you the postulates. Okay, so then, the assumption that gives rise to that is one of these background assumptions.
I assume a sort of finiteness.
So I assume that non-trivial finite systems exist. So by non-trivial, I mean that n is greater than 1. And by finite, I mean that the number of probabilities is not infinite. So once you have that, then you can prove, actually, with this postulates I'm going to give you, you can prove that you can have systems having any n constructively. You do need to assume that there exists at least one type of system, which is non-trivial, yet finite. Okay. So these are the postulates, and I'll go through each of them individually. First postulate, definiteness. I'll go through that on the next slide. The next slide but one. Information locality. I think I'll just go for these postulates in subsequent slides so you understand them. Come back to them. But here's the statement. The statement is that classical probability theory and quantum theory are the only two theories that are consistent with these postulates. Okay, so actually, we have only two theories, not just quantum theory, but both quantum theory and classical probability theory are consistent, and no other theories are consistent with these postulates. And this one postulate here, P4 prime, which I'll read out, there exists a reversible transformation on any system affecting any given permutation of any given maximal set of statistical states of that system. If we can change that, and then if we change that to a different postulate, then we get rid of classical probability theory and we single out just quantum theory. Okay. So in fact, if you want to single out quantum theory, it suffices to add anything to the postulates on the previous slide that are inconsistent with classical probability theory and consistent with quantum theory. And so changing P4 prime to P4 is just one way of doing that. Maybe I should just go through this. Okay, so P4 prime. That's the idea that there exists a reversible transformation on any system affecting any given permutation of any given maximal set of distinguishable states for that system. So it's kind of a very classical idea. A permutation transformation is a very classical kind of transformation. You know, it's just a reordering of the states in some distinguishable set. And we're assuming that that's possible for any permutation and for any maximal set of distinguishable states. Then to get rid of classical probability theory, single out just quantum theory, we have to add, or we can add, just this one word, compound. There exists a compound reversible transformation on any system, blah, 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 blah. And a compound transformation is one that can be made from two sequential transformations, neither of which is equal to the identity. And this kind of basically forces there to exist one state in between. So one state that falls outside the classical simplex. Okay, so I'll go through, in the remaining minutes, I'll go through each of the postulates. So the first one, definiteness. So what this says is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between pure states and maximal effects. So pure states are ones which can't be simulated as mixtures. Maximal effects are the effects associated with the outcomes of a maximal measurement. And we're assuming that there's a one-to-one correspondence such that if you follow a pure state by the associated maximal effect, then you get probability one. And it's only true for that under that association. So this is an interesting postulate, and it gives you quite a lot of things. The most interesting thing it gives you is causality. So it follows from this postulate that choices in the future do not influence the past. You can prove that as a theorem in this postulate. And that's nice because then it doesn't have to be added in as an extra assumption. In most approaches to axiomatizing quantum theory, people add in causality as a sort of background assumption. In the work of Giulio and his collaborators, they added it in explicitly as a postulate. So causality is one of their postulates. In this case, it follows from this assumption, as do a number of other things. Information locality. So here the idea is that if we have a composite system and we perform a maximal measurement on each of the components, then we affect the maximal measurement on the composite. So that's equivalent to a number of other statements. So, for example, this statement, if n sub a is the maximum number of distinguishable states, then this postulate is equivalent to saying that n sub ab for a composite is equal to n a times n b. And that's very natural. It's very natural that if you have a composite system, then the number of distinguishable states is the product of the two systems. And if you take the log of this equation, you get this equation. This is sort of saying that if you want to work out what the information carrying capacity of the total of the composite system is, it's just the sum of each of the components. And this is why I call it information locality, because the information is given, the total information carrying capacity is given by adding together the local parts. In the paper by Massanas and Muller, by Marcus and Massanas, they were actually able to get rid of this postulate by using some of the other postulates. But then I took the attitude that perhaps it's nicer to keep this postulate, not have to add in other postulates. And it turns out this is a very powerful postulate, especially when it's used in conjunction with the permutation postulate. You prove a lot. It looks quite innocent, but it turns out to be very powerful. Tomographic locality. Usually this is called local tomography, but because I wanted to make it sound like information locality, I said call it tomographic locality. This is a very standard assumption in a lot of the work that's been done recently. And it says that the state of a composite system can be determined from the statistics collected by making measurements on the components. And the more you work with this postulate, the more natural it seems. It seems it's very difficult to do things without having this postulate. But really, in this kind of circuit framework, it seems like a very, very natural assumption. It's equivalent to the statement that the number of probabilities required to specify the state for a composite is just given by the product of the number required for the two components. It's interesting that real Hilbert space quantum theory is inconsistent with this postulate of the complex cases of fractions. Okay, people prime permutatability, but I told you about that already. This is just the statement that there exists a reversible permutation for any permutation that permutates any maximal set of distinguishable states, so this picture. So that's like saying that we can perform lossless arbitrary translation of a message encoded with respect to any alphabet to a message encoded with any other permutation of the alphabet. And P5 is the assumption that filters are non-mixing and non-flattening. It seems to me this is a very natural assumption. Filters are used to basically define the part of the world you're interested in when you do an experiment. You send your particle through a pinhole or through slits or something. And it would be difficult to use those kinds of preparations if filters were not like this. So if filters generally mixed your states when you use them, then it would make it difficult to prepare for your pure states. And if filters flatten the space, then it would be difficult to prepare using filters a general set of states. So it seems to me it would be strange if, in addition to truncating the space, filters also flatten the states in the space. So it seems like a very natural requirement. That being said, I'm still hopeful that we can get rid of this non-flattening of the postulate. Okay, well, I don't have time to go through how the reconstruction works. It's a long paper. So that's it. Theorems. With this picture, you can implement an arbitrary filter. So we don't assume that there was a filter. We construct them from the postulates. This is a proof that systems that have the same n are equivalent. An important part of the proof is to show, well, first of all, we show that for a g-bit, g-bit is like a generalized bit. For a g-bit, the states have to lie on a hypersphere, so I think that's well known for the general result. But then we also want to show that all the points on the hypersphere correspond to pure states. It could be that your space is just some restricted set of the points on the hypersphere. To prove that, we use filtering on a G-trit down to a G-bit, along with the non-flattening postulate. And using that, using this filtering, we're able to prove that every single point on the hypersphere associated with a G-bit actually corresponds to a state. And then to prove that the dimension is actually that of a quantum theory, so that k equals n squared, I use a technique due to these guys, which uses teleportation. There's lots of pictures how that works. Interestingly, it involves this kind of situation where you have to close a circuit, where you have a fragment, and you close it. So here's a fragment, and I can feed this wire into this wire. And in doing that, I fix the dimension. Yeah. And that idea, which is in the paper of Giulio and his collaborators, is where you fix the dimension. So that was a key part of the reconstruction, which I took from their paper. Okay, so conclusions. We can derive quantum theory operational postulates. I think these postulates are deeper than the postulates I had 10 years ago. We don't have to assume that there exists a continuous reversible transformation in any pair of pure states. We don't have to assume that systems having the same n are equivalent. We derive that. I feel like these postulates are getting deeper down. I don't think that this is the final word. I think we need still more deeper postulates to really finish this job. But I think it's in the right direction. These postulates only apply to finite dimensional Hilbert space. The reconstruction only applies to finite dimensional Hilbert space. But the postulates could perhaps apply to infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. It'd be interesting to think about whether you could derive infinite dimensional Hilbert space quantum theory with these postulates. I don't know the answer to that. And then correspondingly, can we deal with quantum field theory? I have a conjecture that we can drop the non-flattening part of the of postulate 5. So then postulate 5 will just read the filter non-mixing. And of course, the real challenge, and I think the real motivation for doing this kind of thing, is to go beyond quantum theory to a theory of quantum gravity, which I take to be a more general theory than either quantum theory or general relativity, to which both quantum theory and general relativity are going to be special cases. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
The term filter appear in the first four axioms. So postulate 5 is about the nature of filters. I was trying to remember exactly.
When you go to the but it didn't, I think, the sound filter didn't. It just goes to the the only place the term filter appears is in the last postulate. However, the term filter also appears in the definition of what I mean by a system. So it is implicitly invoked in any of the axioms, all the axioms where I use the word system. So a system is defined to be the thing I have after a filter. Which is kind of useful because, well, for one thing, if I can prove that arbitrary filters exist, then I can prove that I can construct systems with arbitrary dimension. I'm sorry, Adrian was first, I think. Marginally.
I might have been referenced that, but okay. So I was trying to get straight the story about P4 prime and P4.
Okay.
And I'm right that the only reason that P4 kills classical theories is because if you have precisely two things and you permute them by changing them, then there's no way to do it properly. But if you have three or more,
that's right.
Rest just on that.
Yeah, which I find satisfying. It only applies in a very small situation, but that itself is sufficient. Yeah. So suddenly, if you have three states, then there do exist non-trivial sequences of permutations, which are themselves permutations. But in the case of two, they do not.
So if you had some sort of continuous space, like in classical mechanics, or something, then there would always be. I mean, this case of two would never be there.
These words are defined differently, so you have to be careful translating the way you use those words in different cases. So here, in the classical case, first of all, these postulates apply to the finite n case. The finite n case is where you have finitely many distinguishable states.
Right. I know, but I'm just thinking how it might go if you wanted to.
Then as long as as long as you understood, as long as you understood that to go in between, you'd need to sort of go outside the classical simplex in an appropriate infinite dimensional way. Then this might work. But maybe that wasn't your question. What was your question?
No, that was the real question. I mean, the question I originally wanted to ask was about classical deterministic theory. It's not. I'm just wondering whether they fit into this framework or they don't fit into this framework. Because there you don't particularly attribute probabilities to anything. You just have some variables and some equations of motion.
Yeah.
Either they satisfy them or they don't satisfy them. But you don't necessarily, or in general, you don't go further.
Well, you can
attribute probabilities to the initial states. So
you can
does this force you to do that, or what would you say?
Well, suddenly if you have the word compound, then you're forced to have probabilities because then you have to have a state in between two distinguishable states, and so you didn't. And if you were to measure the maximum measurement on the original two, you'd get probabilities.
Well, I suppose we're just doing celestial mechanics or something like that, planetary motion.
Right.
Of course, that's not a finite. I don't know if it's ruled out because it's not a finite state system, but you could imagine doing something similar with finite number of states.
Right.
And then you just have certain allowed trajectories. You know, Kepler's laws are satisfied or something, and all other trajectories are not allowed. That's how the theory functions, I think. But it's not clear that there's any probabilities involved in that.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out, see how that fits into this framework, or doesn't fit, fails to fit in, or...
I think the finite case fits in badly. I mean, I think it fits in, but you would wonder why you were using a probabilistic framework to describe something that was deterministic.
But you think you could use a probabilistic framework?
Yeah, you could restrict yourself to transformations that were just permutations, and you restrict yourself to states that were just states in this distinguishable set.
I see.
In a maximum distinguishable set, and I don't think it would be deterministic. You'd always have probabilities. Restrict yourself to measurements that were maximum measurements on that distinguishable set, and you'd only ever have probabilities equal to 0 or 1. Why you would do that wouldn't be a very sensible thing. It wouldn't be a very sensible framework to use if you were interested in that kind of physics.
Any other questions? Can you say something about how you get this no signaling from the future consequence of postulate 1?
There's a proof. Just wondering if I can give you a simple few words to describe the proof.
Even without describing the proof, can you just say what does it mean to say that?
What it means is that you have a circuit, and then you have some part of the circuit that's connected to the rest of the circuit only by wires that go to the future. Okay. Then if you simply ignore what happens in that extra bit, so you don't care about the outcomes on the boxes in the extra bit, then the probability associated with the piece before doesn't depend on what knob settings you have in that bit. In fact, it doesn't even depend on the wiring of that extra bit. So basically, you can trace out a part of the circuit that's only connected by wires to the future, and the probability isn't affected. It's sort of kind of very natural, even as an assumption, but it's nice if you can prove it from another postulate that you need. As to how it's proven, maybe it's better if I just show you the part of the paper. Because
maybe you can say, where did you build in the asymmetry in time? Where is that in the framework?
It's a good question. I don't fully understand the answer to that. I think...
But presumably you cannot prove the reverse thing, is that right? I mean,
that's a good question. I don't think so. I think the asymmetry is built into in the following fact. You can have, if you look at maximal set of distinguishable states versus a maximal measurement, so they're kind of the time symmetric sort of the time symmetric equivalent of each other. And yet you can have a pure state which is deterministic. What I mean is you have that box, you always prepare that state. It has no outcome, no light that flashes on the box. Whereas if you have a maximal effect, you necessarily have a light on the box that flashes that tells you that that's the maximal effect you have. So there's a kind of asymmetry between those two concepts. And that seems to be where the asymmetry in time comes from. I find that a bit unsatisfactory, actually. I'd like it to be more time symmetric. Do you have an answer to that question?
I have another question. The question is related, of course. Are you somewhere assuming that any state is proportional to one that is normalized, in the sense that when you sum over all outcomes on an arbitrary measure, you give one?
From these axioms, you're able to prove that pure states are necessarily deterministic states, necessarily normalized. And so if you have a mixed state,
From these axioms,
P1. So from P1 it follows, I think just P1.
Are there any pure state?
So pure state has to be any pure state has to be deterministic. So it has to be has to be normalized.
So this implies that any state is proportional to the deterministic one, and this is causality.
And a lot of statements like that follow from this first postulate. I'm not completely satisfied with this postulate, but it gives you so many different things,
mm-hmm.
Including causality, but I think it's ended up being necessary.
Oh, you mean by that that P1 is really top heavy? It does almost all of the work in this group.
No, it does. From P1 you can get a lot of theorems, but then you still need P1 to P4 to do a lot of the work. And P5 comes in sort of quite late in the game. Okay. Actually, incidentally, you can get a lot from P3.
Well, I just remember in the Clifton Moon Halverson setup, they had, what was it, reinformation theoretic axioms. You can throw away two of them.
All right.
And it's still got all the same results. You're not meaning something like that.
No. You still need. For example, to construct filters, you need all these axioms. And filters are essential. You need to be able to construct filters to make any progress in this program. To prove that there exists a reversible transformation between any pair of states, which is essential, you want to show that the hypersphere is the right space. You need the first four. So you need this. It's interesting, you can make some headway, you can prove a lot of theorems just from P1. You can also prove a lot of theorems just from P3. And you can prove a lot of stuff about P5.
But is the P1 a time asymmetric? So is the time reduced of P1 false in general?
So
I'm not sure what it would be, but
yeah. What is the time reverse thing?
I'm not quite sure.
I think
maximal effect there exists. If you're, I don't know.
I think the statement itself is time symmetric, except that the concept of maximal effect and pure states are not quite time symmetric. It is already time asymmetric because a pure state is a different concept from the state that belongs to a maximal distinguishable set. It is already time symmetric. I didn't define S as a pure effect. I guess you could. I don't know how to make that work. I find that whole issue quite perplexing.
If there are two quick questions, and then maybe we can conclude the formal part of the seminar and continue with informal discussions afterwards. So maybe if there are two quick questions, that's okay, otherwise. Okay, so let's...
So if you remove P2 and P3, could you show that real vector space quantum theory is consistent with what remains, or do you really need them to...
I think a good question. I think even just removing P3, P2 is still consistent with because I assume you just take the tensor product to form a composite space. So you're asking if anything there. I haven't proven. So there's a theorem which is one of the appendices that shows that this is true in complex quantum theory. I suspect it's true also in real critical space quantum theory. I haven't actually proven it, so you have to be careful. This, I think, is clearly true. Yeah, I guess if you move P3, then you're consistent with real numbers. I don't know for sure.
If you start with a pure state, and then you allow the system to evolve by interaction with some random environment, like a random Hamiltonian,
mm-hmm.
like NMR,
mm-hmm.
does the random pure state that you end up with count in this formula as a mixed state or still a pure state?
It sounds like it'd be a mixed state in the way you're describing it. If you've got for any specific Hamiltonian, then of course you have a pure state afterwards. It sounds like you're effectively mixing over different Hamiltonians. And so in general I think you would get a mixed state for that kind of evolution.
Well, do you make the conceptual distinction between a pure state that's evolved into a random single pure state, you might not know what it is because you don't know the details of the random plateau on the one hand, and a mixed state on the other hand. It's really, they're two different things. So how does that distinction show up in your
I think it's arguable whether there really is a distinction there. A lot of foundational questions in quantum theory concern that kind of discussion, whether a mixed state is actually a mixture of some specific set of pure states, or whether it's really sort of a mixture, and it makes no sense to talk about which pure state it's a mixture of. I don't worry about that distinction in this work. So from my point of view, it would be a mixed state, very simple.
Excellent. Let's thank you, Samuel.